You're listening to the Portland Diamond Project podcast.
Shut up! You're killing me, Smalls.
Working to bring Major League Baseball and a new ballpark to Portland.
How can you not be romantic about baseball?
People will come, Ray. People will most definitely come.
Welcome in to another edition of the Portland Diamond Project podcast. I'm Mike Barrett, Managing Director of PDP. On this week's podcast, our very own Darwin Barney sits down with NBC Sports Northwest host Justin Myers to talk about MLB to PDX, his time in the major leagues, and some Oregon State baseball talk. Let's get to it.
This is the Bridge Podcast with Justin Myers.
Hold on to your butt.
Brought to you by Toyota.
I like turtles.
A three-pointer for the game.
This is an NBC Sports Northwest podcast.
Beer is a tasty burger.
Wherever you may be, this is Bill Shinley, Rip City.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Bridge Podcast. I am your host, Justin Myers. This week's guest is Darwin Barney with the Portland Diamond Project, but also Major League Baseball career, two-time national champion at Oregon State, and state champion and standout at Southridge High School outside of Beaverton. Really fun conversation as we talk about growing up, playing youth baseball outside of Portland, winning that state championship, and of course going on to start what would become a dynasty with Oregon State baseball and his Major League Baseball career. So, hope you enjoy it. I sure did. Here it is, Darwin Barney on this week's edition of the Bridge Podcast. Thanks for being here. How's it going?
It's going well. Thank you for having me. Times are good. Summers in Oregon are fun.
Well, we were just talking about this before we started recording, and just, you know, as Oregonians, we know the payoff of the winter into spring, and we kind of earn the summer. But now that you get all these vacationers, you get all these tourists that come into Portland, I think it's like this all the time, and you have to like talk them down and convince them not to move here.
Yeah, you know, we're growing fast. It's, you know, that's a good thing for Portland Diamond Project, I will say that. But, maybe not so good for our traffic.
So let's start right there with the Diamond Project. How did you get involved with the group, and what is technically your title?
Right. So, I've known Craig Cheek, the founder of the Portland Diamond Project, since I was maybe 10. Played soccer with his son, played Little League against his son. So we've always known each other. When I stepped away from the game, he reached out. You know, we kind of played phone tag for a minute, and then I ran into him at a Zupans. And next thing you know, we just start talking, and that kind of sparked it, and we met up and went from there. So obviously I was very excited about the idea of baseball in Portland, and what kind of role I could have and how I could help them out. And from there turned into, being a baseball advisor for the group. Our family, we ended up investing as well. So we're kind of all engulfed in this thing. So moving forward, it'd be a really fun thing to happen.
Here's what I'm curious, because when Portland does get a team, and I'm going to be the ultimate optimist and continue to say when Portland does get a team, obviously that's going to be your team. But I'm always curious of us that grew up in Oregon, who our favorite teams were. So when you were growing up here in Portland, who was your favorite team?
I was a Mariner and a Red Sox.
Okay.
I loved Nomar. First game I ever saw was at the Kingdome. I think A-Rod was a rookie. Mo Vaughn was on the Red Sox. So I kind of fell in love with both. My Little League team was sponsored by my dad, Dr. Barney. So we wore the old school Boston hat with the white stick out B, red top, blue bill. So I just naturally became a Red Sox fan from there. Garcia Parra was kind of my guy. Mariners, Red Sox.
Did you do the thing with the batting gloves when you were in Little League?
When I played wiffle ball, yeah. I would do that sometimes. But when I played actual Little League stuff, I think I took it pretty serious at the time. So wiffle ball, that's where I pretended I was everybody else.
So it was funny. I talked to Mike Barrett here on the podcast, and we both grew up being Braves fans because TBS was the only time you could watch
Braver
baseball.
Cub.
And then when the 90s happened and I was, you know, going into like, you know, playing in Babe Ruth and Griffey became the greatest baseball player on the planet and everybody started doing their batting stance like Griffey, and it drove every coach I ever played for nuts because he put his back elbow up in the air, which was unheard of. You couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't. It's funny that, you know, whether it's the Nomar thing or the Griffey back elbow or any of those things where you see these guys and then having coaches trying to talk you down.
Well, you know, I've heard a couple of times the debate for Griffey being arguably one of the best players of all time. The guy could do it all. He changed the game. He brought out the backwards hat during BP. You know, and I will say, if there was a swing that mine looked like in Little League, it was Griffey from the right side.
Yeah.
You know, my stance was narrow, elbow up, had the little...
Little waggle. Little style to the game.
You know, and I hit homers. Yeah, so we were very similar with our game when I was in Little League, hitting it 200 feet over a fence, and he was bombing it. So
let's go back to Little League. When did you first... Can you remember the first kind of organized baseball playing?
You know, I do. I remember doing coach pitch. You know, I must have done T-ball before that. One of my best memories of growing up was when I was 6, my two brothers were 11 and 12, and they had a bunch of kids sick for some reason on a Friday when they were playing at Alpenrose. And so my dad suited me up as a 6-year-old in a Little League Majors game with my two brothers, and there's a picture of us standing in line with my dad in it in our unis, and it's the only time we all played on the same team. You know, and it was quite an experience. I don't recall being overwhelmed.
Yeah.
You know, the story is I scored 2 runs, got 2 hits, and you know, we won the game. So, you know, I think I remember having a lot of fun doing that, and that was a very special day. You know, being able to be teammates with my brothers, which never had happened, never did after that either.
Now, you mentioned your dad was the sponsor of the team. I also read your dad was your coach for a long time in youth baseball growing up.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was my coach too. It makes for interesting conversations on the way home, interesting conversations at the dinner table, and sometimes interesting conversations on the mound. What was it like playing for your dad?
Well, each of those things that you mentioned, you know, something came to mind. You know, car rides to games were really quiet because I always fell asleep in the car, you know. So I found that even when I was playing at the major league level, when I would take a little cat nap before a game, you know, I tended to play better, you know, whether it was my eyes were relaxed or maybe I wasn't foreshadowing the game so much. You know, sometimes thinking about something beforehand too much, you know, cannot be a good thing. You know, and then, you know, we've had our moments on the mound where maybe I didn't have that greatest stuff and he came out and wore me out pretty good. And, you know, those are funny times. You know, I think I heard some things out of his mouth I'd never heard before, and I'm pretty sure that gave me the feeling that I could say the same things, and so I did. And that was an interesting time. But you know, he was always there. I mean, he didn't miss maybe one game in college my whole career. And that's hard to do, home or away.
Mm-hmm.
I think he missed like a half a game to get to my sister's graduation. So, you know, the support was there. Obviously, you know, he had to teach himself how to coach me when I was young. But he was always the guy I leaned on for hitting. You know, he had someone help me with my defensive stuff because he didn't know much about that. But on the hitting side, you know, he always kind of was there for me.
You mentioned it early on, kind of baseball was became your sport. Were you interested in other sports? Did you play other sports, or did you just get locked in on baseball?
You know, I would say soccer was my first love.
Yeah.
I always played soccer, club soccer growing up. I played up a level with the kids that were older than me. You know, but that got hard. You know, you have these club soccer coaches that expect you to be there all year round, and I'm playing basketball, some golf, and baseball, you know, and so that it got hard. I think if that hadn't happened in soccer, I would have followed up on some of those offers. You know, I had a couple calls for college, played in high school pretty good. So, but yeah, I mean, I think that kids that play multiple sports are multidimensionally athletic. You see those Southern Cal kids that only grow up playing baseball. You know, they don't have lateral skills. You don't learn to go side to side until you try to D up somebody in a pickup basketball game. So, I think, those multiple sports, and I always tell parents that, don't tie your kid down. Let them play other sports. And if they don't want to, maybe try to make them play, because it's going to be beneficial in the end.
It's interesting because you're right. You see those kids in California and Arizona, and they're able to play all year round, and they're playing, fall leagues, and they're playing winter leagues. We're forced to go in and do something. Right. I've taken my fair share of ground balls, as you probably you have, in the gym floor. It's not fun.
Yeah, it's not. It's not. So, there's just no option to play baseball here. I tried fall ball one time. I never even played fall ball. And the one time I did, it was like you're playing on muddy fields. And, they've done a good job in the past 10 years of fundraising and getting more turf fields out there. But I still think that baseball fields are the last ones to come around. They usually start with the football field and, it's more teams are on that. But it's coming around. I think, maybe keep some of that rain, maybe help some of us Oregonians, be better at different things.
So let's get into high school. At what point when you were playing in high school, did you realize that, this is going to be kind of my future? Did you have like kind of a light bulb moment? Did it just kind of happen gradually? At what point did you realize like I've got a future in baseball?
I think it was sometime around my sophomore year. Your freshman year, you got guys that are so much older than you. I came into Southridge. I was, the starting shortstop my freshman year. But at the time, you just don't know. Everyone's so much bigger than you. I feel like I was trying to keep up. I was confident, but, it's just a different game when there's 4 years of people ahead of you.
Yeah.
But come my sophomore year, I think that was when I first met Pat Casey. He was at a tournament I was at and just kind of, said, I'm going to keep my eye on you. Love to maybe talk to you in the future. I'm not sure when you're allowed to legally talk to somebody, so I don't want to say too much. But I know it was.
I think the statute of limitations is
it was
is
a
gone.
Brief conversation
yeah.
as
in
friends.
Passing,
yeah.
At a tournament.
Right. And so that kind of, I think that conversation was important for me. Because I got a million letters for these schools across the country. And, Oregon State was ingrained in me early. And, it was my first visit. And I canceled, all my other visits after that one. But, about my sophomore year, I stopped playing basketball and used the winter to really hit the gym and work out and try and get a little bit bigger and stronger. I was kind of one of the smaller guys at the time.
So let's talk about your sophomore year, 2002. You guys go on this crazy run in the state tournament, end up in the state championship game. Now I'll tell you, I was at that game. I was coaching high school baseball back then and Legion baseball with a guy Marty Lees.
Oh yeah.
So I was coaching with Marty Lees, and I remember the 2002 championship game. They're like, "There's this kid you've got to go see. We've got to get up to Salem. There's this kid playing in this championship game. We've got to check out. Got to watch him play." It was Dallas Buck.
Exactly.
But
yeah. No, I know. Dallas was the guy.
But it was Dallas Buck. But yeah. But you guys had this crazy run in 02 and kind of came out of nowhere to win the state championship.
Yeah, in 2002 was pretty incredible. It was we had six starting sophomores. It was our group that came up through Murray Hill and Babe Ruth. And, we'd been together a long time. We'd been successful. I think winning is habitual. We were used to winning. It was something we expected. But in 2002, we got through Oregon City, Jonah Nickerson on the mound. We got through Central Catholic with Gundy on. Gundy actually pitched the game before, so luckily we didn't get Gundy.
Yeah.
And because of that, I think we beat him by like 18. And then, of course, you get Newberg in the final. And so there's your big three that led us to a World Series championship in college that we somehow, as sophomores, got through them all, and they were all juniors. So, it's funny to look back and see the path that we took and the guys that we went through, and then we all came together. But you're absolutely right. Dallas was a phenom. The guy could hit. He was he reminds me a lot of Jeff Samardzija. Super athlete.
Yeah.
Could play both sports. Could dunk, 360 dunk anytime they want. Just an athlete. Just one of those guys. And you know, that was Dallas. And I got to know Dallas a little bit. You know, the year after we won the state championship. Got to know him. We played area code games together, and I think we even maybe roomed together one time. But he got me back for us winning the state championship. I remember it was a tryout for the area codes, and he struck me out on three straight sliders. You know, and Dallas's slider was something, you know, from the Bible or something. It was like epic. I mean, this thing was unreal. So, I mean, even when he had arm issues his junior year in college, he was still beating, you know, all those other Friday starters throwing like 85, 86 miles an hour, you know, and that's just how good he was.
So high school ball, you guys win it in 2002. What are you doing in the summer? Are you playing Legion? You know, you mentioned the area code games. What are you guys doing in the summer?
Yeah, you know, from there, I did a couple different things, you know, like a little USA thing in Arizona. Did the area codes twice.
Well, and the reason I bring it up for those of you that are listening, summer baseball is such a big deal for anybody that is serious about wanting to play at the next level. Summer baseball, especially in Oregon, is a really big deal, and a lot of us played Legion. Or like you mentioned, there's USA Baseball. That's why I was just curious as kind of what your decision-making was, because it is kind of a big deal going into the summer.
I think my priority was with the Docs, and the Docs is Dr. Barney. We were Southridge. Southridge had their own Legion team, and we actually made it to the state championship for Legion, you know, and which is not easy to do. There was teams like the Pepsi Challengers. I think there were like five schools combined into one. And here we are, you know, just a single school out of the Metro League.
I may have played for the Dr. Stewarts
in
Roseburg.
Right, yeah.
We had an entire county, Douglas County.
So we knew that, and we just kept thinking, man, if only we could get our buddies from Beaverton High School over here, you know, how fun that would be. But, you know, for us, it was fun to just be with the same group of guys all the time. So Legion Ball obviously was first and foremost. And then after that, you know, that's when you get invited to the different things. You know, we were never big pay to go to things kind of people. I was always doing other stuff, you know, soccer was all summer too, you know? So, yeah, you know, whatever. Legion Ball was number one for me. And I just don't think you need to play all year round until it's time.
So, couple of misses in high school the next couple of years. I mean, you guys kind of had a big bullseye on your back after winning it in 2002, because you had that big nucleus and a couple of tough losses. But I want to ask you this, because you mentioned kind of running into Pat Casey, and you said that Oregon State was kind of always number one on your list. And here's what I find really interesting. This is about 03, 04, right? This is when you end up signing and committing and signing to Oregon State. Oregon fans who are listening have no idea about Oregon State before they went to the College World Series, because, well, nobody cared.
Right.
Then Oregon State went to the College World Series, and all of a sudden everybody in Eugene decided to care.
Yes, which we take a lot of pride in, by the way.
I know you do.
You're welcome, Oregon fans that were baseball fans.
And I think a lot of Oregon State fans choose to not worry about what happened before 2005, because it would seem inevitable. You have this Portland kid who's got a lot of offers. Big-time prospect. Of course he's going to go to the baseball power that is Oregon State. But that didn't exist in 2003. They hadn't been to an NCAA tournament since 1984.
Right.
So what made Oregon State, a team that at that point was kind of irrelevant on the national scene, it was definitely kind of irrelevant in the then Pac-10, what made you decide to go to Oregon State?
Well, you know, it was a number of things for me. I think first and foremost, the guys that I came up in high school playing against, the Nickersons, the Bucks, Cole Gillespie, these guys were good players. And I knew they were good players. You know, I knew I was a good player, and I felt like these guys were competitive as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were at the same level. And, you know, when you go on your visit and you hang out with Jacoby Ellsbury and Cole and Gundy, and you just realize Coach Casey was right. You know, he came into my living room and said, you know, I think you're the last piece that we need to be a national contender. You know, and I was just, you know, didn't believe him. You know, we'd followed Oregon State, my dad and I, and you know, we'd seen them, you know, have good preseasons like most Division I schools do, and then they've come into Pac-10 play, and then, you know, it's a struggle from there. So at the time, I just wasn't sure about that. You know, went out there, saw the guys, knew what they brought to the table, knew that we had more pitching than we needed. And from there, it was kind of an easy decision for me, which was, you know, let's go be a part of this. You know, let's take pride in the state of Oregon and be here and do that. So at the end of the day, after that visit, it was over. It was an easy decision for me.
So you come into Oregon State, 2005 is your first year there. And as you mentioned, they're kind of loaded at this point of guys that you played against. And I've always talked about this because I've been an Oregon fan my entire life, but I was kind of obsessed with that Oregon State team because here is a team that's making a run in the Pac-10 for the first time in a long time. You guys end up making a run to the College World Series, and it's a bunch of guys I've watched play high school baseball. It's right. A bunch of guys that like you mentioned, Dallas Buck and Gunderson and all those guys, and you and Ellsbury, and just what a great showcase for something that I take a lot of pride in, and that's being a baseball player from the state of Oregon. When you guys started there in 05, you knew there was a lot of talent, but was there a moment where you were like, no, this is something special?
You know, there's something to be said about, you know, if you've never been to the top of a mountain, you don't know what it's like. You don't even know what you're striving for. And for us, I think that was kind of part of it. You know, we thought we were good, you know, but we didn't know. We didn't know for reals. And we still struggled a little bit here and there throughout the year. Obviously, gosh, our pitching and our defense was phenomenal, you know, but you got to hit. And at the time in Corvallis, you know, balls just don't fly. You know, so there was a series in Stanford, I remember, that I think we had a doubleheader, and we ended up taking both of those games in a row. I think that was the moment that our team thought, this is real.
Yeah.
Because Stanford at the time they were the standard. You know, they were so good in our eyes. And then to beat them twice in one day, it kind of catapulted us a little bit. You know, I think we took down the Pac-10 that year. You know, you build that confidence. And then you start to build, you know, what Oregon State is all about. And then, you know, and that has to do with a lot of guys. That has to do with the guys that were there before me. You know, that went through that building process. Without those guys, I probably wouldn't have gone there either. So, you know, it's just a big circle of a culture that we've tried to build.
So now you guys get there in 05, you make this run, you get to the postseason. As I mentioned, the first time Oregon State's been to the postseason, not the College World Series, but just the postseason since 1984. And you guys make this run, you win the Super Regional, and you are headed to Omaha, Nebraska for the College World Series, something that I'm sure you probably dreamed about for a long, long time. What was it like first walking into, was it Rosenblatt still back then?
Oh, yeah.
So it's Rosenblatt Stadium now, not the brand new fancy one that they built. But what's it like walking in and getting ready to play at Rosenblatt Stadium in the College World Series?
Well, there's nothing like it. The opening ceremonies, just the history behind the event, actually getting there. You know, like I said before, you'd never been there. And I think that was part of our weakness that year to go two and out in that tournament was a part of us was just, we felt accomplished to be there. And the funny thing is you see a lot of that in Oregon State's last national championship. You know, the year before was pretty close, right? And then next thing you know, they win. Because getting there is one thing. You know, if getting there is the accomplishment, you know, then what else is there? You know, the years we won it was a totally different feeling than 2005. 2005, we dogpiled to go to Omaha. 2006, we talked as a team that we are going to high-five like we've been there before when we win the Super Regional. Our goal was to be the only team on the highlights. You know, they show all eight teams that get in, right? And they show them all dogpiling. We talked about wanting to be the team that was just like, oh, hey, good job. We made it to the next part. And that was pretty cool to see seven dogpiles and then us. And it's funny, I saw a lot of that in that Oregon State team that just won. But there's nothing like that feeling in 2005. There's nothing like that feeling in 2006 when you win the championship for the first time. I mean, firsts of anything just don't compare.
Well, I want to get back to 2006 real quick, because now you guys are coming in. You were essentially an unknown the year before. You mentioned that Stanford was kind of the class of the Pac-10. Of course, USC and Arizona State and their storied history. And now all of a sudden, here comes these 20-some kids from Oregon that just won the conference, went to the College World Series, and now you're coming in. And USC and Stanford and Arizona State have a lot of pride. They don't want to sit and just let Oregon State kind of have their run. Did you guys feel like, all right, here comes USC and Stanford, they're going to be coming after us?
A little bit. I don't remember, feeling too threatened. We were so focused on what we had to do.
Yeah.
At that point, we didn't lose anybody from the year before. We lost Ellsbury, but I feel like that was one of the main big pieces, that we lost going into that next year, obviously Andy Jenkins as well. But, we had our core, we had our pitching, we had everything we needed, and we were super confident going in. I think that was the year that Mitch came out with the song that was like calling Texas, you're about to get your ring took. We wrote that song before the season even started, and that was basically telling everybody in the Pac-10, look out, we're good, and we're going to try and win the whole thing. And to actually back that up, I think, is like a 1 in a million chance of not looking like idiots. So it was interesting how that all worked out, but you got the right guys around you, good things can happen.
Now, that's a really interesting side note here. Let's talk about this a little bit, because that's the year, as you mentioned, O-State Ballers, I believe is the name, Mitch Canham, your rapping catcher.
That's right.
Who is now
the rapping head coach.
Of Oregon State. Uh-huh. And listen, you don't get to be able, you don't play catcher at a Division I level without knowing the intricacies of the game and having obviously a lot of baseball knowledge in your brain. But when you're sitting there and you guys are hanging out in your dorm, hanging out in your apartment, you guys are writing or listening to your rapping catcher's O-State Ballers anthem, and to think, in about 10, 15 years, this guy's going to be the head guy here. Take over for Case.
Yeah, the funny thing about Mitch is most guys that would do all the rapping like that, there might be something a little bit weird about him, right? But Mitch was always that high character guy either way.
Yeah.
It's just not your prototypical rapper guy. That was just all part of him expressing himself. And some of his best friends are in the music business in Washington, and they're the ones that kind of helped him out and then helped us out the next year. Got to know them really well. He has a good circle around him. The guy's gone through so much. So even at the time, Mitch was a high character guy that, surprisingly, that rapping didn't change any of that. It just, it took off, really. We had concerts. These things were like sold out. And there was just student after student filling these places. And Mitch's buddies were doing, their little concert thing. But the O-State Ballers song, they played it like, they rapped it four different times because people kept wanting to hear it. What a hit that was. I hope they still come out and take infield to that, because, that song just basically, I feel like that won us some games.
So the 06 postseason is really interesting. If I remember right, you guys decided to put yourself in an elimination game almost the entire NCAA tournament.
Basically,
Starting with the regional, put yourself in the breakfast bracket, get behind a game in the Super Regional, come back, and I think you guys were like five or six elimination games just to get to the championship series.
Yeah. You know, I remember we lost to Virginia, I think, in the Super. No. We played a different team in the Super that year, but in the Regional, it was at Virginia, I believe. And I remember walking out of that stadium with Case and him just saying, you know what, we're fine. He's like, we're fine. We're just going to do what we have to do. And, you know, I mean, that's just kind of how he was. That guy believed in us more than we believed in ourselves. You know, I owe a lot of my success to him. Just even my rookie year, I was struggling, and he has me hitting in the three hole. And I'm like, Coach Case, you know, you can move me down in the order. He's like, you want to be moved down in the order? And so he puts me in, like, the six or seven hole or something, and I go 5 for 5. Next game, I'm back in the three hole. So then I'm struggling. I'm like, Case, you know, he's like, dude, he's like, you're going to hit. He's like, don't worry about anything. He's like, you're going to hit. And that's all it was. There was no, at the time, there was none of this analytic stuff they're doing at Oregon State now and all the videoing of the swings. You know, back then it was just confidence-based reps. You know, we worked a lot. We worked hard, and his leadership helped.
So take me to that moment. So you guys, North Carolina, you're in the championship series. You get the out. Here comes the dog pile. Take me to kind of your perspective on what that's like to winning the College World Series.
Well, I mean, first off, both years were different. Like mm-hmm. you said, we lost the first game of the tournament in 06, came back, lost the first game of the final series of North Carolina, and mm-hmm. came back and won. So that year, I didn't get to experience any of Omaha. We played every single day. But I will say that when that last out was made in 06, that was by far the best feeling I've ever had in a baseball uniform. 07 was special. Back-to-back's cool. There's nothing like that first time. What I learned was getting in the bottom of the dog pile in 05, winning the Super Regional, is not the place to be. You go in yelling and next thing you know, you can't talk because you're just like, and you're wondering if you're gonna live. So from every dog pile on, I've kind of, you know, made my way to a buddy first and like cheer, like celebrate. And then I'll make my way to the pile towards the end and jump on top. So, you know, there's a couple pictures of me like jumping on top and this and that. And my friends are like, dude, did you totally plan that? Like, you know where the cameras are? I'm like, dude, no, I just didn't want to be on the bottom ever again.
It's the great ones make adjustments. Darling.
Well, you know, in that moment, I guess I had the larceny to do that. So, you know, I'll give myself props. But, you know, getting squished by a bunch of dudes that are way bigger than you is not fun.
So you mentioned it back to back. And in 07, right, you guys, I think, were the last at-large team in the NCAA tournament.
We were
a lot
close.
Of people were wondering whether you should have been in or not.
And we had to beat a good UCLA team 2 out of 3 at their place, you know, and there were some really good players on that team, Brandon Crawford being one of them. But and we did that just to squeak in as the defending champions, mm-hmm. which, you know, I think it's I almost feel like if you're the defending champion, you better get in the next year, you know, and I feel like a couple teams have gotten snubbed. I'm not sure if Oregon State was one of them or not, like after they've had a good year like that. But that was a big series for us. We squeaked on in. We were team like 63 or 64 into the tournament. But goodness, were we hot. I mean, we got hot at the right time. We had a bunch of guys that had already won it the year before. So there was no wide-eyed. Mm-hmm. You know, there was like 10 of us that were there for our third year. You know, so going to Omaha, you know, and seeing Aaron Andrews and seeing all the things that have to do with college baseball World Series, there was none of the wide-eyedness going. It was more, we're here, we're playing really well, you know, let's get down to business.
You know, I talked to Joey Harrington, talked to Derek Anderson, kind of get their thoughts on what it was like to kind of get that call in that moment. But you were still in the middle of your college baseball postseason.
Right.
But take me to that moment when you do get the call. After they're in the middle of your junior year from the Cubs.
So that's the biggest difference. Obviously, when Rutschman got drafted, they had a little draft party for him, right? Mm-hmm. The guy was expected to go in the top 10. you know, none of us were expected to be a top 10, 20 pick at the time. So we were at practice. You know, I remember the draft kind of started. We're on the field, and I'm practicing knowing that if with every minute going by, I'm not picked.
Yeah.
I don't remember stressing too hard on it. You know, my junior year wasn't my best year. But then I just have a vivid memory of being on the field. Coach tells me to come on over, and he's like, hey, you've been drafted by the Chicago Cubs. And, you know, that it's just an interesting feeling for a reality like that to set in. And then you go back and keep practicing. You know, so, I mean, at the time, it wasn't like your draft.
Did you have a good practice after, or were you kind of a little bit lost?
I don't remember. I mean, your mind is going so many different ways. You know, you got the biggest term in your life coming up still. You just got drafted, and, you know, now you're that guy that's representing the Cubs while you're playing at Oregon State. You know, they always put, like, who they're drafted by and this and that. So, you know, it's definitely different. It's different when you still have different goals in mind and you've already been, you know, basically purchased by somebody else.
So how does the timetable work? So you get drafted before the College World Series happened. You guys get on your run, Super Regionals, College World Series, back-to-back College World Series champs. As you mentioned, you make the adjustment, get in the good spot on the pile. How long before you are headed to minor league baseball?
Well, there was a predicament first. So for me, Mike Stutes and I made a deal that after we won in 06, we basically were like, we knew how hard it was to win. Winning at anything is hard.
Mm-hmm.
We made a deal that if we won again in 07 back-to-back, we were both going to come back for our senior year. Next thing you know, we win. And Mike and I just remember that moment. It was during the parade in Corvallis. I remember, I just vivid memory of just looking at him like, what are you going to do? You know, because they give you the question like, so what are you going to do? Are you coming back next year? You leaving? You know, so that was interesting for us. We both kind of decided, okay, it's time. You know, back to back is plenty for us. You know, and then from there, I remember, you know, you go back to Corvallis, you go to your place, and you're basically saying goodbye to whatever life you have there. And it's not long. I mean, it's a week. It's a week, and then you're gone. You win. Once the tournament's over, it's like you're home. You pack up, take your stuff back to your other house, and then, gosh, you're out of there. And the next part of your life starts. So I'd say the turnaround was about a week or two, and then next thing you know, you're one of 190 in an organization. You know, but that moment didn't happen until the next year. So you go play, you know, on a short season team or whatever, finish the year out, and then the eye opener is your first spring training. You know, your first spring training, you walk out on that field with millions of guys out there, and you. How am I going to separate myself? And, you know, the ones with talent, you know, the ones that are headstrong, I feel like have a better chance than the ones that are kind of overwhelmed by the number of people out there.
Well, and the other thing is, and I'm curious how you adjusted to this, because I spent time working with the Eugene Emeralds and being around minor league baseball, and it was always interesting to me how wins and losses are not important. Are not as important as at-bats and innings. And I know some organizations care about winning. Some organizations, it's a numbers game. We've got so many prospects. They've got to get so many at-bats.
Yeah.
But how is the adjustment of you going from a shorter college baseball season where wins and losses can be life and death, and the priority of winning is the utmost high, to all of a sudden now, yes, you're teammates with other infielders, but you're also trying to get to AA ahead of the guy that you're riding on the bus with. And winning a game or losing a game maybe isn't as important as going 2-for-3. How was that adjustment?
You know, that's actually, you're absolutely right. I will say my first full season in Daytona Beach, Florida, you start to feel a lot of different emotions, right? So your whole life is about the team, and it's about winning, and how can I help the team? Then all of a sudden, there's a guy I was playing with, and I remember after a game, he told me, like, you know, if we don't win, you know, and I go 3-for-4, he's like, that's still good for me. And I remember at the time thinking, like, no, you're wrong. You know, I was just, you know, just out of college. And then we end up winning the whole thing in Florida State League. Yeah. It was the only place in the minors I played a full season. And one kid came up to me, and he was like, thank you. And I go, what do you mean? You know, this is the night we won. He's like, thank you, man. He's like, I've never won anything in my life. And he goes, and now I'm here winning championships with you. And he was like, thank you for that. And then you just start to realize, man, how lucky we were at Oregon State to be good. And that, you know, some people haven't won anything, and you just can't take it for granted. But as you move up, you start to learn that, yes, I would say that the higher in the minor leagues you go, winning kind of matters less to guys. I would say at AAA, you know, most guys want to lose, especially if they're not called up in September, because they want to go home.
Yeah.
You know, if you make the playoffs, you're not making much extra bonus at all, but you're playing for 2-3 more weeks. So, you know, at that young age level at high A, I had none of that. I wanted to win. I wanted to be there. There was no thought of going home. But as you kind of move up, you kind of start to sense as a team, like, hey, guys, like, yeah, it's great to win, but season's over if we don't. So it's kind of funny how that works.
So let's fast forward a little bit. Take me to August 11th, 2010. So you get the call. You are now a Chicago Cub. First off, how'd you get the call? How'd you get the news? Take me through the whole the whole sequence of events.
So I was in Des Moines, Iowa, and I remember I got the call. My manager actually called me, Ryan Sandberg, and said, you know, hey, you're going up to Chicago. You know, from there, I remember standing outside of our apartment, you know, and my wife's inside, and you're like, who do I tell first, you know? And it all happens so fast, because now you're leaving the next morning. You know, you're just gone. And your wife, your kid, they're still there. The team was in San Francisco, and it was a really interesting thing. So when I got called up, they traded Mike Fontenot to the Giants. So Font went from our dugout to their dugout, and I got called up. And I was always a shortstop. My whole life I was a shortstop. I had actually worked a little bit with Sandberg at second base, because when Starlin Castro was in Double A, I was in Triple A leading the league in hitting and defense. He was in Double A leading the league in hitting, not so much on the defensive end. That came later for him. He ended up moving to second base. But when they called him up from Double A, I remember talking to Sandberg, like, what do I got to do? You know, I'm the best shortstop in this league. They just called him up. So we started working at second base. Mm-hmm. We started doing stuff before games, but I kept playing shortstop every day. And then, of course, you know, game reps and practice reps aren't the same. So I get called up, and I'll never forget, you know, driving down the bay, you know, to the San Francisco Stadium, and just seeing the stadium in the distance, and you know, knowing that's where I was going. I mean, just a little stirry.
Yeah.
Nothing crazy yet. A little tired from the early flight. But then you get in that dugout, and the game starts rolling, and you're like, you know, I wouldn't say take it for granted, but you get used to a big stadium. But that first year, every stadium you go in, you're just like, holy moly, right? So, of course, it's bottom nine, defensive replacement for a double switch or something. So I go into second base, a position that I have zero game reps at. My first ever position in the big leagues, playing second base. So it's like a base hit, a walk. Now we have bases loaded, and I want to say there's like one out or something. So ground ball to short, I got to turn this double play, or we lose and it's my fault. I'm just praying. Now, I was a confident guy, but I was praying that either the ball got hit to me so that I could make the flip, or we lost. Like, hit a walk-off. Dude, I don't want to turn this double play. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I mean, this guy's going to come sliding into me. And to be honest, this is not a good moment in my mentality, but someone hit a gap, and they won it, and I was the happiest person on the planet because I didn't have to make that routine double play turn that I wasn't ready to make. So that day was an interesting day. Kind of, you just get, that's the thing at the big league level, sometimes you get thrown into the fire.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of my starts were at third base that first year. And I remember the manager walking by and someone had a hurt heel and he's like, you ever played third? I was like, nah, can you play third? I was like, yeah. He goes, do you want it? I go, yeah, I want to play third. So I played maybe like a 4 or 5 starts in a week at third and, you know, got my at-bats, got some hits. And you know, you just, it's not ever scripted like you think. It, you just don't know in professional sports.
So you start off your professional, your major league career on the road, but tell me about getting back to Chicago, Wrigley Field, and putting on pinstripes for the first time. What's that like?
Well, I will say that the first time I got to Chicago, I couldn't believe that the visiting clubhouse in San Francisco was just as nice as our home clubhouse. But I had known that. We played a game at Wrigley Field when I was in AAA.
Gotcha.
You know, so I saw the clubhouse. You know, I saw kind of what was coming. And but, yeah, obviously, there's nothing like playing at Wrigley. You know, I think at times it can almost be a disadvantage for the Cubs to have 3 home games because there's guys out there that want to play at Wrigley. It's like going to Fenway. You get that extra energy and, you know, maybe we're on our 5th game in a row day game. These guys are coming in for 3 games at Wrigley Field. They got all the energy in the world.
Yeah.
They're excited to play in front of the Ivy. They're excited to be in Chicago and on that, you know, it's like a museum, that stadium. You know, but for us, it was just another day game eventually. You know, so I think that can kind of play against them a little bit. But, gosh, there's nothing like going out there and hearing the organ. And you know, it took me about a year till someone told me, you know what song they play when you hit, right? Because, I mean, you don't hear it. But they were playing, like, the Flintstones song when I would come hit. Da, 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 for Barney, you know, Barney Roller or whatever. So... there's just a lot of little quirky things about that place that make it really special, you know, and I really, really cherish my time there.
So you get called up at the end of 2010, 2011, you go into big league spring training, have a great spring training, and now opening day roster, you're a big leaguer now, and now heading into a monster 162 game season. Did you ever get a little bit overwhelmed? Did you ever get to, and I know you mentioned, you know, it kind of does become work, but now it's not the call up anymore. Now it's not, hey, right, can you play third base? You're a second baseman and we're starting the season.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of an evolution of things. You know, you can only be in awe so long and play well.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, that spring training was interesting. Jim Hendry was the GM at the time, and I remember him coming up to me before spring training started. I spent the offseason of 10 before 11 in Arizona working out with the team the whole time. And Jim Hendry came up to me and said, hey, we don't need to go out and get a, you know, veteran backup shortstop, do we? And I was like, F no, we don't. I was like, I'm your guy, right? So he's like, all right. And of course they went out and got somebody. They got, you know, just somebody just in case. And so nothing was guaranteed. You know, I was fighting for a backup shortstop job in 2011. Came out, had a great spring. They had two guys that were going to platoon at second base. You know, so I was, you know, trying to win the backup shortstop job. About halfway through camp, I'm playing really well. And you know, coach comes over and is like, hey, you go over there. You're going to be here. And that was the first, halfway through camp was the first time I started playing second base. So I had about 2 weeks to prepare for the season. And And I was in a platoon situation with another right-handed hitter who absolutely raked left-handed hitters. So the first 3 to 4 weeks of the season, I was playing against righties. I got the opening day start. It was a righty on the mound. It was amazing. I didn't even know I was starting opening day till the day before. You know, they weren't sure. And I remember it was like the last day or two of camp. I'm on deck at Hohokam Park, and I look over at my manager. I go, "So did I make it?" They didn't even tell me. He goes, yeah, I thought you knew. I thought you could just do the math. And I'm like, this is my first time ever breaking with a team. I'm not just going to assume anything. So I went from there to an opening day starter, and I might have had my best 2.5 month, stretch in the big leagues ever until I was in Toronto to open up my major league career. So that's what it takes to earn a job, is you got to play well right away, and you got to play really well.
So here's what's interesting to me. So high school, you guys win state championship as a sophomore. You're in the playoffs, in the hunt every year in high school, good teams. Summer league, playing in the state championships, playing in big time games. You go to college, 3 straight college World Series, win 2 of them back to back. You have had an unbelievable amount of success. You mentioned it in the minors. Yeah. You win the championship.
Had a Team USA gold medal in Cuba.
Team USA gold medal on top of all that. Your 3 full years with the Cubs, 71-91, 61-101, 66-96. How hard was that for you, considering that you've never played in last place?
You know, I remember it being the hardest thing ever. The first 2 months of a season, I remember, were easy for me, because you're playing to win. And playing to win was something I'd done my whole life. You do things to help the team out. If you're trying to move a runner, you might get a hit, and good things happen. After you're out of it, you're playing for yourself.
Yeah.
You're playing for your family and your job next year and numbers. It changes everything. And I remember having numerous conversations with people around the team, strength trainers, people that had been there forever, with how do I do it? I'm struggling with this. What's wrong with us? Why can't we win? I mean, we had all these guys that were, when I first came in, 2011, we were good. Derek Lee, Marmol, Aramis Ramirez. Our team was unbelievable. We just couldn't get past. I think that year we got to like 5-5, 6-6, 7-7, 8-8. It was interesting. We hit the 500 mark all the way up for like a while. We just couldn't pass it. It was just that kind of a year where things just didn't really work out. But the team was good enough, and I couldn't figure it out. And then it just kind of got worse. And then you trade away everybody that's anybody every year. And then until finally you're the guy that gets traded. And that was the hardest part. The bitterness part of playing there was, we just never had a good year. I had a couple of good years personally, but, you want to win. The whole thing getting drafted by the Cubs was winning World Series. I mean, they ingrained that in your mind. And to feel like a failure, that kind of sucked. But, when they won, I was happy for a lot of those guys that I knew over there and for a lot of those fans that I had heard, I can't die till we win a World Series. Well, I wonder if they took that back.
You mentioned having a personal good year. 2012, you win the Gold Glove. Were you a little bit disappointed when you realized, because I didn't know this until I think I saw Harold Reynolds talking about this on TV. The Gold Glove Award is not a trophy. They just take a glove and paint it gold.
Right.
A little bit disappointing. You win the Gold Glove, you figure you got this great trophy that you're going to be able. Nah, it's just a glove that they paint gold.
Yeah, they put it on something though.
On a thing.
So they make it like a trophy. It looks great. I'm not going to complain. That's probably one of my most prized possessions. That's not living.
Yeah.
That thing meant a lot. I mean, the work that went into that, Silver Sluggers are at least their trophies, right? You're right. It's not. You could take that thing off and bend it around a little bit, but it's pretty special. You can't have gold on your glove, you know, at all because of, you know, only if you have that that award and that trophy, you know, it's not easy to do. It's not easy to win anything at the highest level like that. And, you know, that was a huge accomplishment for me.
So playing with the Cubs, you mentioned it. It's always kind of tough because at the end of the year, guys get traded, guys get released. All sorts of moves are happening because you guys just are not getting the wins. And then all of a sudden now you start kind of bouncing around a little bit. How tough was the business side of baseball? Because, I mean, all of us who grow up and we play and we dream of making the major leagues, and you got to accomplish all of that, and then all of a sudden now it's a business and a job.
You know, I learned right away about the business. You know, Cubs-Cardinals was my rivalry. And then I learned real fast about the Dodgers-Giants one. You know, I got cross-checked by the Giants. They had Dan Uggla playing second base, and he was kind of kicking it around a little bit, and they really needed someone to play second base. And this was when the Cubs had designated me and said, hey, this is going to get us to trade you. We'll let you know where who's going and what, and we'll kind of take your, you know, get your say on it a little bit. Didn't really do that, but I got a call from Coach Casey, and he's like, hey, just got off the phone with the Giants. You know, they're going to get you. They're going to grab you tomorrow and trade for you. And I was stoked. I was going to move into San Francisco and play every day. I was going to play second base. Get a call the next day, and Jed Hoyer, the Cubs, was like, you know, we traded you to the Dodgers. And I was like, what? Who? I couldn't believe it. You know, and at the time, it was that was the business, right? Because then all of a sudden, they're like, we need some shortstop. They had Hanley Ramirez at short. They wanted guys that could play defense behind him. And so now I think I go from thinking, hey, I'm going to go to San Francisco on this really good team and play every day, to now I'm kind of a backup. And, you know, from there, you get there and they send me to the minor leagues and you know, the Dodgers, they were good. They were honest. We're going to be there for 10 days and we'll call you up, get you some time at shortstop. And, you know, while I was there, I got to know a lot of guys. I got to know Jock Peterson and guys like that. And I remember Jock telling me, like, man, I asked the front office. I was like, why did we get Darwin? You know, obviously, you know, we like him. He's good. But Jock was like, but I asked him, like, because we just didn't need a guy like you. We had Miguel Rojas. We had this and that. And the front office told him, well, we didn't want the Giants to get him. So we gave up a better guy than they were offering, and I went to the Dodgers. And, you know, what a wrinkle in my career that was.
Yeah.
You know, because from there, I went to camp the next year with the Dodgers. You know, in arbitration, they signed me back. I played really well with the Dodgers the whole time I was there. Broke with the team, had a great, gosh, one of my best spring trainings ever with the Dodgers. Was there for like 2 weeks, and then they sent me down. They needed someone, another pitcher. And, you know, I was never really fully a part of their plans. I was just taken from the Giants. And that's kind of how I look at it. Unfortunately, I spent most of the year in AAA, ended up playing really well. They wouldn't even trade me. The Blue Jays told me, like, hey, we tried to trade for you at the deadline. We tried to trade for you before that. Dodgers wouldn't let you go. And they didn't let me go until September, when I had just gotten home from like a couple postseason games in AAA. For some reason, they decided to trade me to Toronto then. And then, you know, I go to Toronto, play well. You're not postseason eligible because you were picked up in September. So, you know, my time with LA was interesting. It was career changing a little bit, but that's the business. That's how it works. They didn't want a premier defender to go to San Francisco.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard that if LA sees San Fran with a bigger jumbo jet than them, they go get a bigger one. You know, that's just kind of how those two work. So, you know, it was an interesting time in my career for sure.
So I would love to sit here and talk about a ton of other stuff, but we're up against the time, and I don't want to keep you too long,
yeah.
But I want to get back to kind of what you're doing now, because you did get, as you mentioned earlier, a nice stint with the Blue Jays. I know I read you said, you know, baseball's kind of becoming fun again. Did you kind of feel like you at least left the game kind of on your terms?
Oh, I absolutely did.
Yeah.
You know, Toronto was fun. I got to play shortstop for about a month or two straight. I got to play every day, and our team played really well. I got a bunch of postseason starts. You know, there was a lot of firsts for me that year. So that was super special, being able to be you know, a part of Toronto, and the whole Canada thing is just unbelievable, having that whole country behind you when you're playing well. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot from guys like Josh Donaldson on you know, what it's like to actually be confident. You know, not just faking confidence,
yeah,
but what's real confidence. You know, so Toronto was it was special. You know, and you know, leaving the game. You know, the last, I got some loose bodies in my arm and a bone spur in my arm. Just last year and a half, it was rough. You know, it was just exhausting getting needled every day before a game just to throw. And when you're coming in as a defensive replacement at third base, you better make the throw. You know, you're in there to make a play. And it just got too hard. And, you know, I was also battling some guilt. You know, being away from your family for that long, mm-hmm, your kids are growing up. I'd never seen a sports game. I'd never even seen my kids play a sport before. And my daughter at the time was, my oldest was eight, 9 years old. You know, so carrying that guilt around made the game not as fun, even though I was having some of my better years. You know, so with the arm and with all that, you know, I decided that if I didn't break with the team in Texas, that I was going to call it. And, you know, sometimes I regret doing it, but I would never regret these 2 years I've had with my kids.
So now you're here in Portland working with the Diamond Project, and we mentioned it right at the top of the episode. Kind of take me to kind of your role now heading into the future in trying to not just gain support here in Portland, but to try to convince Major League Baseball to get us a ball club.
You know, well, you know, people have said that I bring legitimacy to the group. I bring a baseball angle to it, kind of this generation of baseball. We have, you know, obviously some other guys that are willing to put their name behind it that are different generational guys. You know, but for me, you know, I think one of the names that was thrown around was like chief baseball advisor or you know, just baseball advising on that side. You know, unfortunately, we don't have a baseball team yet, so there's not a bunch of advising to do. You know, but when that time comes, my job is to, you know, make sure that Portland is a destination that free agents want to go to. And that's kind of, you know, my focus. I'm very traditional. I'm, you know, the type of guy that, you know, although I like progressiveness, I like, you know, what baseball is and has been for so long, you know, and so, you know, I think that's a good side to bring into this group. You know, this group it's an unreal group of people. You know, I couldn't be more confident in who we have leading this group. Just, you know, unfortunately for me, the types of things I do for the group is, you know, you're looking at it. You know, it's this, it's going to charity events and repping the hat. You know, sometimes I can't wear the shirt because I can't even go to a restaurant without someone bothering me, you know? So it's an exciting time, you know? I would love to be here still, you know, when that happens, when that team comes, you know, because who knows? I might go work again, do something, but you know, it's all in preparation for this. If I go work in baseball, I'd love to be ready for, you know, to apply and be the right guy for a job here.
Darwin Barney, appreciate the time. This was awful lot of fun. Of course, best of luck with you guys and the Diamond Project and kind of keeping the ball rolling and enjoy your time back in Portland.
That'll do it for this week's Portland Diamond Project podcast. Be sure to head to PortlandDiamondProject.com to sign the petition and show your support for MLB to PDX.